Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. One of my favorite songs ever is called Underdogs. It's by The Coup, a rap group from the Bay Area. It sounds like this.
This is for my fuckers who got bills. This is for my fuckers, I'm check 1, 2. This is for my fuckers, never live like a hog. Me and you, toe to toe, I got love for the underdog.
I raise this glass for the ones who die meaninglessly, and the newborns who get fed intravenously. Somebody's mama called a job and a welfare fraud case. When she breathes, she swear it feel like plastic wrap around her face.
It's a painful, profoundly empathetic snapshot of poverty and the stuff that people do just to get by. Here's the story behind it. A couple decades back, Boots Riley, that's the front man of The Coup, his dad lost a couple $100. This friend of Boots got the money from his dad, promised he'd pay him back, but he never did. And yeah, Boots is a reasonably successful rapper, but he isn't rich, and neither is his dad. So losing the money hurt. He was angry. And Boots did what a lot of rappers would do at first. He took pen to paper and started writing a diss song. But as he was writing, he thought about where his friend came from, about what drove him to steal the money. And he realized that he wasn't writing a diss track anymore.
And just while writing that, thinking about his life, this is a guy who had, when he was a kid, got burned and covered in burns and lived, you know, it's hard to even talk about it. But anyway, this was me writing a song that came from an understanding of a whole situation that he was in, and that came first from a point of disgust, and ended up with this song.
It's Bullseye. This week, Boots Riley. He's just written and directed his first film. It's called Sorry to Bother You. It's great. We're going to talk about that a lot. But also, we'll talk about how he got together with E-Rock, with whom he founded The Coup.
He and I met while working at UPS.
Oh, okay. There we go.
It was me, him, and Spice One loading up bellies of the plane.
It's a pretty killer lineup.
Yeah. And we would hide from the managers in the bellies of the planes and rap.
Also, The Coup's been around for a long time now, over 25 years. And in that time, Boots has met some very devoted fans.
Like, people come up to me with tattoos of The Coup logo. I mean, it's cool, but they're often like, where's yours? Obviously, you have one. I'm like, you know, I'm not that committed to this group.
And finally, I'll tell you about a beautiful record that I heard completely by accident. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. So we see this show as a show about what we think is great in culture. And for my money, one of the most compelling creative forces around is a guy named Boots Riley. And if you don't know who that is right now off the top of your head, don't worry about it. You will soon. He was born Raymond Lawrence Riley. He grew up in Oakland, California. His parents were activists working in the NAACP and the Progressive Labor Party. And Boots wanted to carry on that family tradition in art. At first, he went to film school. Eventually, he found his calling in hip-hop. And with his friend E-Rock and DJ Pam the Funkstress, he founded the hip-hop group The Coup in 1991. The Coup are and were an explicitly political act, but they're also humane. Boots told stories when he rapped, painted pictures from real life. He talked about social justice and poverty and racism through the eyes of real people. A lot of hip-hop is about prosperity, stories of overcoming a system that's been rigged against you for centuries, success stories. The Coup, with Boots as their front man, wanted to get rid of the system entirely.
Presto, read the Communist Manifesto. Guerrillas in the mix, the Guevara and Manesto. So,
what a brother with an afro now.
Yo, go a flow for the Mac and we the hoe. So grow, cause the Lucian brothers might get hung. Rhetoric flowing from the tip of my mouth. Say tongue, deficit.
Money spit.
Catch the glint.
Oh my nine, as they cut welfare 25%.
And I descent as I clinch and raise my
we
fist.
We did away with that.
So you could get with this. It's a twist, cause we're overthrowing.
The coup have been a working group for over 2 decades. But about 6 years ago, Boots's career took a left turn. He started working on a movie. He told his friends about it, asking acquaintances in the entertainment industry for advice. Sometimes he'd just corner a producer at a party for 15 minutes. He wrote a screenplay, and thanks to a combination of audacity, determination, and luck, the finished product is hitting theaters this month. It's called Sorry to Bother You. Maybe you've already seen the trailer. It's set in Oakland, in kind of an alternate reality. Lakeith Stanfield is the star. He plays Cassius Green, a black man who gets a gig doing telemarketing. And it's in that job that he finds the key to success. Do a white guy voice, and magically, people listen when you call. And from there, it just gets weirder, a lot weirder. And I don't want to spoil anything for you, but there are elements of sci-fi, horror, and comedy. And the whole thing is great, an instant cult classic. Let's take a listen to a little bit from the beginning of the movie. Here, Cassius is just starting in telemarketing, and he can't seem to get anybody to actually talk to him on the phone. And in this scene, he gets some advice from a veteran coworker, the guy who sits next to him, played by Danny Glover.
Well, you don't talk white enough. I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife. Any white is just proper. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the real deal.
Okay, so like...
Hello, Mr. Everett. Cassius Green here. Sorry to bother you.
You got it wrong. I'm not talking about sounding all nasal. It's like sounding like you don't have a care. Got your bills paid. You're happy about your future. You're about ready to jump in your Ferrari out there after you get off this call. Put some real breath in there. Breezy. Like, I don't really need this money. You've never been fired. Only laid off. It's not really a white voice. It's what they wish they sounded like. So it's like what they think they're supposed to sound like. Yeah. Like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regal View. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
Boots Riley, welcome back to the show. It's nice to see you.
Good seeing you too, man.
I feel like the last time you were on the show, it was... I think it was a live show in San Francisco, and that was a long time ago.
Yep.
I'll say 6 or 7 years ago anyway, and you were working on this movie.
Yep.
This was like why did you even think – how did you get the temerity to think that you, a grown man with a full career in another field, you know, a 20-year, 25-year career in another field – could change lanes like this?
Well, I guess it's because when I decided I was going to rap, I didn't know how to rap either.
But I mean, the difference is like when you decided you were going to rap, you were 17 or whatever or 15.
No, I was like, 19 or 20 or something
so
like that.
Yeah, so everybody thinks they can do everything when they're 19.
I still think I can do everything. But I don't think I have the time to figure it out. For everything. But yeah, I think because of that career, the idea that I know that there are steps to figure out with how to do things. I've done things that are hard before, you know, so I knew this. But I started out in film school before I was known as a musician. I went to San Francisco State, but we got a record deal in the middle of that. And so I was out of there quick.
Shout out to all the Golden Gators out there.
Yeah. And and so it was probably easier for me having done a career in art. And also, you know, I've been around music video sets. I know people who've made films in different ways. And so being an artist has made me honest with myself about my strengths and weaknesses, and honest with myself about what I do know and what I don't know. So I was able to identify those things and go out and find it and meet Guillermo del Toro at a luncheon and corner him and hound him until he gave me all the information I needed, or get David Gordon Green to be a mentor and let me shadow him on when he went and shot stuff. So, you know, if someone that has built a house tells you they're going to build a boat, you'll believe them because they actually did something they said they were going to do. And so that helped me.
That's interesting. I was thinking about the beginning of the Coos career, and you know, I caught on as a teenager a few years in. You already had a record deal and stuff. But when you got a record deal, it was basically the only time in the history of hip hop that lots of urban music artists from the Bay Area were getting big record deals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were in the right place at the right time.
It was like MC Hammer had happened. MC Hammer had changed the face of hip hop,
mm-hmm.
coming from Oakland.
And Digital Underground was
exactly. And there was Digital
Too
Underground,
Short.
There was Too Short, there was these other kind of corollary things.
And what the thing about business, especially entertainment and the music business, is people are not creative. So they're like, this worked. We don't know what the hell happened, but we do know that these three groups were from Oakland. So got any more Oakland groups?
I think a lot about this novelty record by the country novelty band Riders in the Sky, who are like a band that you would – they're very lovely and charming, but they're like a band you would see at a state fair.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe on a Prairie Home Companion or something. And I had this tape of theirs as a kid that had this running joke where somebody would say, has it been done before? And the other guy would say, yeah, sure, millions of times. And then the business guy would say, great, we know it works. But what's wild about it to me is that, you know, you certainly couldn't have been more divergent aesthetically from Hammer.
Yeah.
I mean, I like Hammer. I have no beef with Hammer.
Yeah,
but like,
we were very different from everybody. I mean, I think our first review that came out was by Danielle Smith, who then went on to be the editor of Essence, but then was just writing for the Bay Guardian. And she was like, sounds like Boots Riley is trying to find his style. And I think you could apply that to everything I do right now. And what she meant by that was there was no place to plug us in. Like, oh, you like this group? You'll love this. You'll love the coup. It was hard to do that, and it was only because Stu Fine at Wild Pitch is a crazy dude, and he may or may not have been able to capitalize to the best of his abilities on these groups that he signed, but he signed some amazing groups like Gangstar and Main Source and, you know, all these groups that other rappers love, but may not have, you know, while they were on Wild Pitch, flourished as much. So we got found out by that label, and it was just kind of lucky for us.
Let's hear one of the records. This was like, I mean, in some ways, this is like one of the closest things to a hit you had in the very early part of mm-hmm. your career. This is from your second album, Genocide and Juice, from 1994, and it's called Fat Cat's Bigger Fish.
It's almost 10 o'clock, see, I got a ball of lip for property, so I slip my beanie on slopper and promenade out to take up a collection. I got game like I read the directions. I'm wishing that I had an automobile as I feel the cold wind rush past. But let me state that I'm a hustler for real, so you know I got the stolen bus pass. Just as the bus pulls up and I step to the...
That's a story song. It's great. Story song, and it seemed like you were very deeply committed from the beginning to that idea of narrative. That's not to say that all coup songs are narrative at all,
yeah.
But it was relatively few of
no,
them.
No, I love. It's just that I love that one. I wanted to be a filmmaker, so the idea of being able to make someone see a film in their head while they're listening to the song was like, cool, this is much cheaper than making a movie. So that excited me. I also obviously was very influenced by Slick Rick and Ice Cube, things like that. So those were heroes, and wanted to do that as well. But yeah, story has always been a big part of things to me. And I think that's how, you know, as in meeting some organizers through my life growing up, the really effective ones were sometimes these very long-winded people who told a lot of personal stories that made you understand the concept and were very funny. And I think I've emulated that in my work.
I mean, my dad was a professional organizer for most of his life, and he's still alive. He's just retired. Yeah. And goodness knows, I went to plenty of events and protests and so on and so forth when I was a kid with him. And I think that narrative is a really essential part of organizing, not just in terms of one's own personal story, although that can be a really important part of it. But anytime you are trying to share a message, putting it in the context of a story, whether it's the story of an event, you know, I was just thinking of my dad's best friend helped organize a protest in favor of, or a demonstration in favor of, the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was a bunch of folks who were partially paralyzed took their wheelchairs up to the stairs in front of Congress and got out of their wheelchairs and dragged themselves up the stairs, right? Mm-hmm. That's a story that they are telling.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so compelling that these, you know, it's only, whatever, 15 people.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what makes it so powerful.
Yeah. It's being able to cause empathy in the person that you're talking to, which allows them to see an analysis of the world through your eyes. And so, and also just, I'm just a fan of storytelling, and I'm a fan of, like, that story has, you know, it starts off one way and goes a whole different direction. So I always was a fan of taking people on that journey and taking those journeys myself.
You know, like Fat Cats, Bigger Fish, which is a story about some folks essentially getting together to rob rich people at a party. And it is tonally, you know, this is something that you made in 25 years ago.
Yeah.
It tonally really reminds me of Sorry to Bother You.
Huh.
Like there's, you know, Sorry to Bother You gets more intense than Fat Cats, Bigger Fish does.
Yeah.
It gets really intense.
Yeah.
But it has the same kind of freewheeling satirical quality that also encompasses, you know, kind of recognition of real humanity. And visual stuff, too. I mean, like, in that song is one of my favorite stanzas in a hip-hop record ever, which is, I would leave it to you to say because I'm no rapper. You'll be surprised to learn. But it's about the streetlight and the ground.
The streetlight reflects off the piss on the ground, which reflects off the hamburger sign turn around, which reflects off the chrome of the BMW, which reflects off the fact that I'm broke. Now what the f*** is new?
Right. And that is very plain. I mean, it's not like it's not fancy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's nothing fancy about it. It's intensely visual.
Dave Eggers School of Writing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's that's the thing is, I mean, painting a picture. For me, it's hard to talk about those things because I kind of don't know what I'm doing, you know, the whole time. I'm trying to find something to do. And the stuff that really works, I could try to break it down and be like, this is why it works. But you don't really know. You don't really, you know, you have ideas and those ideas keep you going. But, I think once I worry that once I try to start qualifying exactly what I'm doing, that's when, you know, I'll get too in my head and not be able to do those things.
The first time I interviewed you for this show was, I don't know, by a long time ago, let's say 15 years ago, maybe.
Okay.
And we talked about the rappers who influenced you.
Yeah.
You really talked a lot about Ice Cube.
Mm-hmm.
Who I think is, you know, it makes a lot of sense because Cube is funny and kind of plain and humane, and he's also, like, ferocious.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought of Too Short, who raps about completely different stuff than what you rap about most of the time, mm-hmm. but also has that kind of plain quality, like it's declamatory, you know
and,
what I mean?
And that's something.
It's like an announcement.
Yeah. And that's something, yeah, there's songs that we have that are influenced by some of that style, and some of that is a little bit more of an identity thing for me because I'm in Oakland, so okay, let me do something that's like that, much like there might be a jazz musician from Mexico City that's like, okay, now we're going to do, you know, something that's ranchero style or whatever.
Right.
You know, and, you know, so I
it's like a piece of who you are. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Even as a guy from San Francisco, like I feel like there are these artists who are so deeply tied to where I'm from that they feel like a part of me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like rapping Forte went to my high school. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like that's
yeah.
It just means everything, that thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I wonder is at the time that the coup was coming out, you know, Bay Area hip hop and especially independent Bay Area hip hop was moving in a much more abstract kind of super lyrical direction.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there's plenty of. I mean,
oh, like,
there was
like
there was
Hyro.
A, there was yeah, yeah. yeah. I mean, there was also you know there was also a lane of you know mob music was really flourishing at the
mm-hmm.
time too.
Yeah.
But you know, there's all this kind of Hyro, you know, Souls
yeah.
and Dell and all this stuff. That
yeah.
was super lyrical, and you never became super lyrical.
Hmm.
And I wonder if you ever if you ever thought, like, maybe I should make, like, maybe I should focus on, like, developing crazy styles.
Yeah. So to me, to me, I think of them more as style purveyors.
Right.
And to me, like, super lyrical is like Nas.
Sure.
Or something
okay.
like that, which is different. And I definitely have aspired to
that the Nas
sort of thing. But
the
Hyro, they kind of had this style that felt really lively and
yeah.
And actually got picked up a lot. But it influenced hip hop in more ways than people think about. I was talking to Andre 3000 the other day and him talking about how much Souls of Mischief influenced them, you know, and I just dropped a big name, but that's cool.
No, that was like the best anecdote you possibly could have told me. Like, you really couldn't have hit a bigger home run with that name drop in this room. I don't know how NPR listeners feel about that, but.
Yeah. And there was a big thing that came out of Oakland that influenced a lot of style. But in my head, so in the movie, Cassius Green has this existential crisis that is there and I'm always in the midst of that. And I'm a lot of times writing my stuff thinking about people listening to it 100 years from now. And although there's no way to predict how that will be looked at, I am also thinking about how it's read, you know. So for me, it's not just an auditory thing. It's something about how it's read. And so what I'm doing with my verses in the lyrics and the words that I choose and the pictures that I paint to me is just as important as the style and the flow. But so I definitely tried to have some of that mix in there.
Even more with Boots Riley after a quick break. Stay with us. When we come back, we'll talk about the recent passing of former coup member and DJ Pam the Funkstress. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for Bullseye and the following message come from Showtime and the acclaimed series The Affair. This summer, the journey continues in this intimate relationship drama. A fresh start should mean a new beginning, but the past forces everyone to crash back together. Starring Dominic West, Ruth Wilson, Maura Tierney, and Joshua Jackson. Don't miss a new episode of The Affair every Sunday on Showtime. To try a free month, go to showtime.com and enter code Bullseye. Offer is for first-time subscribers only and expires July 15th.
The Greatest Discovery is a podcast about Star Trek Discovery and so much more, Ben.
We watched the entire first season of Star Trek Discovery, but now we're finding all kinds of interesting ancillary topics to get into.
We're interviewing our favorite people.
Reading comic books.
And we're updating you on the news about season 2 of Star Trek Discovery.
It's news you can use, and it's every 2 weeks on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You got 1 week to fix a country's failing preschools. Go. On Rough Translation, a bold experiment by a country to transform its culture of teaching. And it works. Until the very people that most want these schools to succeed start getting in the way. Rough Translation, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Boots Riley. He's the frontman and founder of the hip-hop collective The Coup. He just wrote and directed his first ever feature film, a sci-fi comedy called Sorry to Bother You. It hits theaters July 6th. I want to play a little bit of another great story record that you made. And this maybe is the one that I feel the most strongly about. And it's called Me and Jesus the Pimp in a 79 Granada Last Night. And this is from my guest Boots Riley's group The Coup's album that came out in 1998, Steal This Album.
City lights from far away can make you drop your jaw. Sparkling light sequins on a transvestite at Mardi Gras. There's beauty in the cracks of the cement. When I was 5, I hopped over them wherever we went to prevent whatever it was that could break my mama's back. Little did I know that it would roll up in a Cadillac. And matter of fact, she couldn't see him like a cataract. And on the track, she went from beautiful to battle axe. And back at home, she would cry into her pillow, vomit in the commode.
This is a story about a young man whose dad gets out of jail and they go for a drive together. And it's also, I mean, I think the first time I heard that song, 1998, so I was 17. And I think I heard it. It was right when the record came out, and I happened to be in this class with this guy, Ricky Vincent, who teaches at San Francisco State. Mm-hmm.
Uhuru Maggot.
Yeah, the Uhuru Maggot from KPFA Radio in Berkeley. And this class was not a hip-hop class, but this song came out, and he's like, this record just came out. You got to hear this. And I remember sitting in this class. I'm 17. I'm surrounded by college students. I'm a junior in high school. And I'm just sitting there with all of these people who are, like, as far as I'm concerned, the coolest people in the world because they're all 21. Mm-hmm. And I was just crying listening to this story. And because the story was so transporting, I think it took me a while to absorb its sort of allegorical content. It becomes a story about the young man's mother and his relationship with his parents. And ultimately, I don't know if songs can have spoiler alerts, Boots, but it came out a long time ago.
You don't need a spoiler alert.
Ultimately, he kills his father.
Yeah.
And I wonder what you were thinking about when you were writing that song.
Honestly, this is probably one of my most, like, masturbatory sort of things because I was just like, I want to write a good story. I want there to be all sorts of little things that you have to catch up on. Like, there's, you know... So it was,
I think it was like 5 years after the song came out that I talked to you about it the first time. And you're like, oh, you know, 79 Granada, that's because that's when the revolution was in Granada.
Well, that's what I thought. But this is when I wrote it. I really didn't have access to the internet. So it was really 81 that it happened.
Okay.
And but yeah, so that is, yeah, I have all sorts of little things in there that probably people won't pick up on unless they're really nerding out on it. And all sorts of references, and that sort of thing is fun to me. And I think maybe I do that in Sorry to Bother You as well in the movie. I wanted to make something that was chock full of references and also had a larger allegory about the myth of black capitalism. Again, most people will hear it and it's just the story that happens, you know. And I also wanted to make something that got across something emotional. I think starting out like being all about lyrics, you can get really caught into these conventions that are supposed to mean you're a good lyricist, which are like similes and metaphors and being clever.
Similes that are usually puns more than they are similes. Yeah. Like they don't really bring a lot of clarity. Yeah. It's more just like a cute thing you said.
Yeah, exactly.
Which can be very cute. Shout out to Chino XL. Yeah. But like,
yeah, and it's all about being clever, which subtracts you from the emotion of art. You know, like nobody wants a clever painter or a clever, you know, they want something that a piece that you know, like. They don't want a sculpture that just makes you laugh. Oh, the dick is in the ear. That's cool. You know, they want something that is that
somebody in art school is writing that down real quick. Put in ear.
Yeah. They, you know, so this was kind of an exercise at trying to figure out a story that could move me enough to translate that onto paper and pen and into a song, to translate an emotion in there. And I think this was like the beginning of me being able to do that, which then did change my songwriting style, to the chagrin of some of my fans and, you know, but to the delight of some people that became fans after that.
I think it's also a hip hop record by a man about women that feels very full in the way that it embraces the problematic relationships between women and exploitative systems, and also men who participate in those exploitative systems in a way that's much fuller than, you know. There are a lot of hip hop records by dudes about women are either misogynist or they're I love my mom.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, great. We all love our mom. And I've honestly enjoyed hip hop songs of both of those types.
I love your mom too.
Thank you. Yeah, my mom's great.
She's a teacher and everyone seems to love her.
Yeah. But like I feel like from listening to the song, that was a choice you made, that you as a dude wanted to make a song about women that was richer than some of the other songs about women that were out
there. Yeah, I think that, I didn't approach it from that standpoint, but I guess my standpoint is that sexism and patriarchy affect women the most, but oppressing women makes men's life worse as well. Like, what effect does living in a world like that have on you, on your personality, on your soul? I'm saying that you living in a world where masculinity is defined by oppressing women,
violence and dominance,
is not a full world, and you kill part of yourself. And so that was the point of it, is that it's not, we shouldn't just be against these things because we're against the oppression of women. We should also be against them because we want to live life to its fullest and be as free as possible.
What was it like for you when, as the years went by and the coup was in many ways what you would call a band, but it was also a hip hop group, which is to say that initially it was the three of you. It was Pam the Funkstress DJing, E-Rock, and you emceeing.
Yeah.
And, you know, after a few years, E-Rock left and went and got a job. I don't know if this is actually true, but I remember that I feel like everybody would say, oh, yeah, he works at FedEx now.
No, he became a longshoreman.
Oh, there you go. So that's a good job.
Yeah, it's like $100,000.
Yeah, that's
like, dude.
I was about to say FedEx is a good job because I had an aunt that did great working at FedEx. But
the confusion is that he and I met while working at UPS.
Oh, okay. There we go.
It was me, him, and Spice One. loading up bellies of the planes.
That's a pretty killer lineup.
Yeah. And we would hide from the managers in the bellies of the planes and rap.
So he left the group after a couple of years. And then after many years, she has since passed away. But after many years, Pam the Funkstress, your DJ, essentially left the group to have a job, to run a business. She was a catering business.
What it was is she always was running a business. She bought the place that she was working for. She worked out a deal with them and bought it in like 98. So she was already doing that for a while. But her business paid way more than going out on tour with us. And she tried to go out on tour with us and let a family member run it while we were on tour. And she almost lost the business. So she was like, I'm not doing that again.
So what was it like to you to think, you've always had these big dreams about what the coup is, more than just a band, I think. You know, you've always seen it as a way to communicate a message and move a movement.
Yeah.
What was it like to you to lose these friends in this effort to reasons that were very reasonable reasons, like not reasons that you could object to?
Yeah. No, I mean, with E-Rock, it just totally made sense. It didn't feel like a knock or a blow. And, you know, I still communicate with E-Rock. You know, matter of fact, we did a lot of work with the Longshoremen during the Occupy movement. You know, he always was a reluctant member in the first place because he was my friend from UPS. And one day, New Year's Eve, going into 1991, I was like, whatever studio is open tomorrow that will answer the phone on New Year's Eve and they're open tomorrow, I'm taking my money and I'm making this music that I said I was going to make. And got a guy to answer the phone, and then I realized I only had enough to pay for the studio, didn't have even bus fare after that. And so I called my friend E-Rock up, who had a car. And, you know, because at the time I was driving this moped, and so I had to bring records to the studio. There was no, you know. And so he came, and on the way there, I was like, man, you should be in the group too. And he was like, okay. And that's how he got in the group. And throughout the whole time, he was just kind of like, you know, like, okay, I guess this is what we're doing. But so it was a lot easier for him to do something else. But
you and Pam had been partners for 20 years.
I mean, I think as far as just talking about the impact of not working with different people, I think that I'm so stuck on getting the next thing done that it just goes immediately into problem solving mode. I'm not really mourning the past of what happened. I'm more like, okay, this is how we're gonna have to get this next thing done. And you know, just the way that we worked a lot of times was that I'd do an album and Pam would come in at the end and lay the scratches down. And so it definitely was a change in kind of the feeling of who we were and who we like kind of identified as. I think there's something about that in life too. Like you just keep pushing and you have all this work to do and you don't really have time to, you know, maintain friendships or be with family enough. And there's all of this stuff. And so I've lived this life of doing that. Like decades go past and you're just working to try to make this thing happen. And that's kind of maybe why the coup has, like, we never got hooked in nostalgia because it would be easy. Like, there's a lot of groups that came out when we did that are just touring based on, we're from the 90s, you like the 90s now, you know what I'm saying? And I never was interested in doing that because we never blew up, I knew that maybe blowing up was on the horizon and, you know, didn't pay attention to what people said about this or that. And so my music was always about here and now, and our sets were always about here and now. We weren't like, here's the songs, you know, we were like, we got this new shit you're gonna love, you know. And it was more like, okay, these are the factors we're dealing with, we're going on. It wasn't really like a sentimental connection to what I thought the coup was. You know, there was like, it's a, like people come up to me with tattoos of the coup logo. I mean, it's cool, and but they're often like, where's yours? Obviously, you have one. I'm like, you know, I'm not that committed to this group. I don't know. You know, who knows what's going to happen.
It's only 25 years, you know? 27
yeah.
years.
You know, yeah, yeah.
You must have had to think about what the group meant in a retrospective way when Pam got sick.
Oh, yeah.
Because you were, you know, because you were still the public figure in the group,
mm-hmm.
you were kind of the conduit of information about her illness when she was really sick. And I imagine that you must have absorbed a lot of stories about the meaning of her work to people and by extension, your work to people.
Yeah. It's hard for me to feel like, wow, I really did that or anything like that about the stuff that I've done, because the goal of the movement that I want to see is so much greater than people liking the music. You know, like for me, it's like, check, good. Now there's this other thing. So emotionally, I'm glad that people connected to the music, and it means a lot to me. But it's not in a way that you would think would be satisfying. Like,
do you let yourself feel satisfied about anything?
No, I don't think I do. I just, you know.
Because you're in middle age. You're allowed to be happy about some things now.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard. It's hard for me to, I have never taken a vacation. I've been a lot of places and had a lot of fun. But it's always, the only way I can have fun is if there's some reason that I'm there. Some reason that I'm doing it. And I think, you know, that's valid. Like, you want, there's some people who, you know, maybe work a tech job in which that their job was doing art and engaging with people in different places. And so my work is not, I'm not lifting boxes or anything like that. But, you know, so there is something to be said for that. But I think being on stage and showing this movie, I sit through a lot of screenings of the movie and seeing people, and sometimes, you know, I'll get asked, oh, are you going to sit through the screening? I'm like, oh, hell yeah. People are, this is my work, and I get to see people interacting with it. At those moments, that feels like the closest to satisfaction. Oh, this worked. Or even when it's like not working or something like that, it feels like an engagement. And that's the closest thing that I feel to satisfaction.
We'll finish up my interview with Boots Riley when we return from a break. He'll tell me that even though he advocates for change in all of his creative work, he doesn't think that art alone can start a revolution. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for Bullseye and the following message come from Starbucks. Introducing new Starbucks Plus Coffee K-Cup pods. With twice the caffeine compared to one pod of Starbucks K-Cup coffee, it's an extra boost to help you make the most of your day. So get up, get going, and get two times the caffeine with new Starbucks Plus coffee, the coffee that keeps up with you. Available in Starbucks Blonde, Medium, and Dark Roast K-Cup pods for the rich taste you love. Look for new Starbucks Plus coffee where you buy groceries.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Boots Riley, wrote and directed the new film Sorry to Bother You. It's an absurd, brilliant story about telemarketing, race, and monsters. You can see it in theaters starting July 6th. He also fronts the Great Bay Area rap group, The Coup.
You talked about the way that in your lyrics you tried to have emotional connections to people's problems in the world.
Yeah.
And I think that you're as good as anyone there is at drawing connections between kind of real human stories and problematic systems. And a song that, you know, another one on the very short list of rap songs that make Jesse cry. Like, it's a real I've loved hip-hop my whole life, and, like, it's a real short list. There's a lot more songs that make me want to party. Is a song called Underdogs that's from that same record, 1998. Yeah, I mean, let's take a listen to it.
There's certain tricks of the trade to try to halt your defeat. Like taking Tupperware to win all you can eat. Returning you ish for news saying you lost your receipt. And writing four-figure checks when your accounts deplete. Then all your problems pile up about a mile up. Thinking about a partner you could dial up to help you out with foul stuff. Whole family sleeping on the futon while you clipping coupons. Eating salad trying to get full off.
What's interesting to me is you have these songs that are so specific and so humane, but very rarely, especially for an MC, but for a songwriter in general, very rarely are you writing about yourself from a first-person perspective.
Yeah. It's interesting because that one, to a certain extent, was. I started that song. I had a friend who actually appeared on a couple Coup albums. He went by the name Point Blank Range, and he died recently, like a couple years ago. But something had happened where he had kind of scammed my father out of a couple $100s, and this was somebody that we had helped a lot, like, you know, not only with his music and stuff like that, and you know, I started out writing like a diss song, like about it, and just while writing that, thinking about his life. This is a guy who had, when he was a kid, got burned and covered in burns and lived, you know, it's hard to even talk about it. But anyway, this is a song that came out of that. And the reason that it's hard is because he died recently. And he kind of lived hustling and sometimes betrayed his friends. And this was me writing a song that came from an understanding of a whole situation that he was in, and that came first from a point of disgust, and ended up with this song. So definitely is really personal, and is one of the only songs that I do a cappella. So, and I had actually forgot about the origin of it until, like, years and years later.
That you have been feeling this anger towards this friend who had stuck it to your dad, and that had led you to think about those circumstances that you recognized.
Yeah, definitely. And he was a really good rapper, too. He's on the Coos song Kill My Landlord. He's on, what's that other one? Interrogation.
You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Boots Riley of the rap group The Coup. His debut movie, Sorry to Bother You, is out soon. So in the movie, you have two main characters, one of whom is going through extraordinary financial success as a salesman and has to deal with the implications of that for his community, his peer group, the labor movement that he leaves behind as he becomes more and more rich, and also what he's selling. And an artist who is his girlfriend, who is dealing with her feelings about the value of what she does and dealing with, you know, there's some ambivalence in the film about, like, what is the impact and value of art as well. Was that something that you just were those ideas just ones that you had been working in your hands, like smoothing a river?
Those are the ideas that I'm struggling with all the time, you know, and to a certain extent, every, you know, there's Stevie in Place Squeeze, who's a union organizer, and Jermaine Fowler plays Sal, who's kind of like always making light of things. They're all like parts of me. And the problems that they're dealing with are ones that I'm always questioning myself about. And is this effective? How do I make it more effective? And on the Cassius side, what does it all mean? How do I make use of this time that I'm here? How do I make it important? And so all of these are things that are running through my mind at all times.
That's a lot of load to bear. I mean, that's something that I personally struggle with too. And I try and check myself once in a while and say, like, it is okay to, like, leave the world better than you found it. You don't have to transform the world personally.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, maybe it's okay that, like, you know, I do a really dumb comedy show that's not about anything, right? Mm. On that really dumb comedy show that's not about anything, I do have to occasionally remind myself, like, once in a while somebody is really sick or their mom is really sick, mm-hmm. and they're driving home and they, you know, send me an email and they say, I just wanted to have something that made me feel nice.
Yeah.
For 20 minutes. I kind of have to remind myself. But, like, if you are always looking at the top of the mountain, changing the world, which I know you believe really strongly in changing the world.
Yeah.
Revolution has always been your explicit goal, right? A monumental change.
Yep.
That's a lot to carry as a person.
Well, yeah, and the problem is that no one person is supposed to carry it. And that's the reason for organizations, is because no one is going to change anything on their own, which is kind of the fallacy about art, is like, I can make this thing that will change the world. It's not even effective if you're not connected with people that are doing things that cause a material change in the distribution of wealth, honestly. You know, this idea that's out there of, like, just let your voice be heard and that's enough, is also leads to this immense pressure on one person. Like, because, yes, individually, we're not effective at doing anything, really. Like, we really can't even feed ourselves individually. You know, it takes a lot of people to get food onto our plate, you know. So changing the world, and by that I mean making a world in which, and in my mind this is what I'm talking about, making a world in which the people democratically control the wealth that we create with our labor. Making a world in that way is not something that's going to happen from one artist saying the right thing. I think that the key is, And often that's how activism is approached as well. It's like, there's a thing, let's go to it. There's this other thing, let's go to it. Let's, and it's people not necessarily having the time and organizations not approaching it from the sense of building an organization that can help each other to do these things. And so, yeah. Some of those pressures and some of those worries come from the amount of work that it takes for me to make things and I don't write very fast. I don't, you know, do anything very fast. So my way of working, if I'm going to actually produce these pieces of art, is one that does not really allow me to do a lot else, which is why the times when I've gotten involved in stuff, I've had to quit doing music or doing art of any kind. So it ends up being isolating, not only politically, but with family and friends, because it takes a lot more work. And I wouldn't be doing it if I only allotted 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day to doing it. I'm always working. I'm always feeling like, you know, one reason I like movies is because I can finally escape and be okay with not the things that I'm not getting done right now.
Not that your movie allows for that much escape. I'm like you really keep people on target.
Yeah. Well, I also,
with the tonal evolution of the film.
Exactly. Yeah. I wanted to make a movie that kept you engaged, not like, you know, there are definitely movies where you know the structure and they're good movies. Partially because you know the structure and the beats within what the director is dancing in, and you can see what they do with that. But this is one where I think the structure hopes to keep you engaged and on your toes. You're not going to think, oh, right about here is where I can go to the bathroom. You're going to understand from it, like, you might go to the bathroom and you're going to miss a very good part of this. So go to the bathroom before you see the movie. So I wanted to keep people engaged with that, to give that feeling of that hopefully life brings. And I know I've kind of been painting more of a bleaker picture of life in this interview, but you know, that it's,
well, it's a very joyful movie. I mean, it's about really scary things about the world, but it's a joyful film.
Yeah.
Boots, I got to tell you this, you know, as a guy who made art that was really important to me as a teenager, when you found a new lane, you know, nothing's more important than the art that was important to you as a teenager. And when you found a new lane, I was like, oh no. This guy I admire is going to do something I really don't like, and it's really going to bum me out.
Graffiti Bridge.
Absolutely. And I went to your movie, and man, did it deliver. So I feel like proud of you for blossoming in this new medium, and I'm so glad that you took the time to come back and be on the show. It's nice to see you again.
Thank you, man. Thanks a lot. Glad you liked it.
Boots Riley. His feature film debut is brilliant. Seriously, it's very funny, very bizarre, like nothing else you will ever see. It's in theaters July 6th, and you don't want to miss it. It's called Sorry to Bother You. And if you haven't checked out The Coup before, well, you've got a lot of great music to look forward to. Try party music. Start there. Every week on Bullseye, we like to leave you with a culture tip from me. We call it the outshot. There's something to be said for serendipity. I was in the record store the other day, Gimme Gimme Records in Los Angeles, if you're keeping track, and I was just kind of flipping through the new arrivals, off in my own world, and then suddenly, it was like a film effect. The music on the speakers clicked into focus, and I turned toward the guy at the counter. I said, "What is this, dude? Is this like a gamelan or something?" "Nah," he said. "It's Max Roach, the jazz drummer." It's this thing called Boom, said the counter dude, from like 1980. Crazy that Max Roach was doing this kind of experimental stuff so late in his career. Yeah, man, I said it's cool. Can I buy it? $10, he said. Sold, I said. When Roach founded Boom in 1970, he wanted to explore the aesthetic possibilities of percussion, but it was also a socio-political statement. A decade earlier, Roach had recorded We Insist, the Freedom Now suite, the album that led the vanguard of jazz as politics. Now he was widening his scope to the world. Roach saw the drum set as the quintessentially American instrument, borrowing hand drums from Africa and the native people of North America, snares and bass drums from Europe, cymbals from the Middle East, and asking its player to coordinate all their hands and feet to manage the cacophony. Boom embraced that international spirit, and particularly the spirit of the African diaspora. As an African American, Roach was aware of the way that his people had been disconnected from their historical cultural context by slavery. Boom was an act of reconnection. Now, you would think that an all-percussion record might be something like, say, Rich versus Roach, which was the drum battle record that Roach made in 1959 with Buddy Rich. You know, like a contest of virtuosity, big crazy solos. I mean, stuff like this. There is virtuosity in Boom, and there's a bit of cacophony too, but mostly there's melody. I mean, it's easy to forget it because they're percussion instruments, but xylophones and vibraphones and marimbas and even the musical saw are all very melodic, and the songs on Boom are songs, beautiful songs. Boom is a theoretical project, a political and social project. It's also real music. I don't think I'd have found Boom if it hadn't been for serendipity. I wasn't looking for it, but I'm glad I had my ears open. That's my outshot. That's all for this week's Bullseye. I want to give a special thanks to Dr. Sean Leah Bowden. She wrote her dissertation on Max Roach and Boom. I found it on the internet, and it was a huge resource for this week's Outshot. Bullseye is recorded at MaximumFun.org world headquarters overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California, where someone pushed a shopping cart with a water heater in it into the lake, first into the shallow end, and then a little deeper. Was it rescued? Did it disappear into the lake? We don't know. Is the lake warmer now that there's a water heater in it? So many questions have come up for those of us who have a view of the lake from our desks. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. He had help from Casey O'Brien. Our production fellows at Maximum Fun are Jesus Ambrosio and Shayna Deloria. Our senior producer at Max Fun is Laura Swisher. Our interstitial music was provided to us by the great Dan Wally, otherwise known as DJW. Our theme song is by the Go Team. Our thanks to them and their label, Memphis Industries, for letting us use it. All of our past shows, over 15 years worth of interviews, are available to you for free at our website, MaximumFun.org. And several years, somewhere between several and many years, are available to you in any podcatcher you choose to use. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. And while you're at it, you can check out the Bullseye page on Facebook, where we share our interviews in an easily shareable on Facebook format and share news and cool stuff that we find on the internet. Like this week, I shared a really interesting commentary by my friend Jay Smooth about the new Beyonce Jay-Z record. Okay, that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.